Hello and welcome to the Modern Fairy Sightings podcast, where we listen to people's fairy encounters. But take heed, we're not talking about winged Tinkerbells here. These are real fairies, real encounters that took people like you and I by surprise. Stay a while and hear their stories. My name is Jo Hickey Hall, and I'm a folklore researcher. Hello, dear listener, how are you? I hope you're well. We are starting to experience the transition in seasons here from summer into early autumn, and it often seems to trigger shifts for many people, sometimes illnesses too. It's a time for being true to how you really feel and resting when you need to. I'm going to keep this short, but I know that you're going to love this episode. Paul Sinclair is a highly acclaimed researcher from North Yorkshire in England, and the phenomena he has uncovered is simply mind-blowing. In this episode, he talks about his own experiences, as well as some of the encounters he has written about in his excellent Truth Proof books. Highly recommended. Links to Paul's website and the books are on the show notes at scarletofthefae.com, and check out his Thursday night live stream on YouTube, which is his Paul Sinclair channel, where he interviews different guests each week. In fact, I enjoyed being a guest on his show in early August 2022. Thanks so much to all the Curious Crew for their generous support of this project, and a shout out to our new Curious Enchanter, Alicia. Welcome. Join us on Patreon if you'd like to support this show, and follow me at @remain_curious on Twitter and on Instagram. My contact form does appear to be up and running now on my website, and again, apologies to anybody who wrote and didn't hear back from me. For a long time, the contact form was just not working, and the messages that were sent via that form were just disappeared into the ether. I've never been able to receive those. So if you did get in touch and you didn't hear back from me, please do try again through the website now, and that should all be fixed. Enjoy the chat. Look after yourselves, and above all, always remain curious. Time to renovate. Time to renovate. So I'm really excited to welcome to the podcast Paul Sinclair. Paul is a researcher of the paranormal and high strangeness. He's based in Northeast Yorkshire, and he is the author of the excellent Truth Proof series, which I am just devouring. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Jo. It's great to be speaking with you today, and hope we can get through a few little bits of information and entertain the people who are listening.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been listening to you on The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. I'm a massive fan of Howard. And, you know, just the encounters that you are uncovering, the stories are just fascinating. And, you know, it ties in so much with the sorts of experiences that I'm speaking to people about and the others. And it just seems to me that, okay, they might be, you know, different in their descriptions, but these, you know, encounters with the paranormal and the supernatural, these otherworldly beings, as it were, there's something that ties them all together.
Without a doubt, there's a, we might not know what it is, but there's a common thread that runs through all genres of unexplained phenomena, should we say, and it's there. I mean, a lot of researchers, I would say in years gone by, maybe not so much now, I think they're starting to realise this now, but maybe in the past, you're sort of true, I don't know, dyed-in-the-wool, nuts and bolts, flying saucer man would not have entertained the possibility that spheres of light could be associated, light forms or cryptids. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe part of thinking was that some researchers would want to say, well, they're obviously travelling in these things. And I'm without any knowledge of what exactly is happening, I don't think any of us could say that. What we've got to say is what you've just said, Joe. There's a connection. There's a common thread. There's some kind of symbiotic relationship that runs throughout it all. There's some ingredients that they all need and they're all sharing. And they might not even be aware of each other. You know, it's difficult because we know that there's loads of armchair experts out there who'll be saying, no, I know what's happening. But if you did, and if you're listening to me now, if you did, you'd be putting the answers out there and everybody would be listening to you. But we simply don't know. All we can establish really is that there is a reality to this, be it UFO related, cryptid related, the fae,
yeah,
you know, any aspect of the phenomena. You're going to get your charlatans, you're going to get people who've maybe had an experience actually, but they've just embellished that experience. But they, yeah, but there's people out there, Joe, that are really experiencing this, that sort of up close and personal, and they're the people that we want to be speaking to.
Exactly. And this is what comes across in, you know, the encounters that you've shared in your books again and again. Sometimes it's these chance meetings, like you might be in the pub, you've perhaps given up on meeting someone that will talk to you about a certain thing, and then suddenly you bump into someone and they might know someone who you know could talk to you, and it works like that, doesn't it? And you know, and you end up speaking to these very, very ordinary people who have experienced extraordinary experiences in their lives.
Yeah, the bulk of them are just like myself and you and everyone else. And I mean, even the people that have got some kind of rank or notability, they're still only experiencing the same thing and similar things. And it's fabulous, but it's like a snowball. It kind of, I think years ago, you know, when I was working 24/7 as a joiner on building sites, obviously this interest was just as strong, but you have to forge a living, don't you? You have to sort of provide for your family a little bit more. So I wanted these reports. I craved this information. I loved it if somebody had got some account that were interesting. But what it's got to a stage now where there's that much, I can't actually keep up with it. You know, I'm making folders and politely getting back to people and saying, you know, I might be a few weeks, but please don't think I'm ignoring you, because it's just that hectic. It were great to sort of step back after I'd written the last Truth Proof book and say, that's it with books for a while. It's not it with books, but just for a while. And I'm going to concentrate on the witnesses, gathering more information, going to these places. I mean, Friday, we spent the night at a place called Jugger Howe, which is on the North Yorkshire Moors, and it overlooks the forests of Langdale and Broxer, and it absolutely fabulous location. You're looking down into deep ravines that are ancient woodland and forest, you know, oak trees, not just pine trees, and all sorts of fauna down there. And these are the places where these things, that if we talked about the cryptids, have been seen. What are they? I don't know. Are they living and breathing? My gut feeling is they probably are, but not in the way that we'd perceive a mammal to be living and breathing. These things are transient. They're in and out of our existence. Otherwise, they'd be seen more frequently than what they are. It's just almost like a lottery if you see one.
Oh, gosh, you know, there's so much to talk about that. I wanted to speak to you about, because some of the encounters that you shared in your books are fae encounters, which is really interesting. And there are a couple of really incredible werewolf encounters as well, which we must get to. But first, I just wondered if you could, you know, tell us how you got into this. So you mentioned that you've always had an interest. How did this begin?
Well, I would have thought, we can't say an exact age, but I'm thinking it's from from early childhood. Probably I'm 59 now, 1967, I think, were the first time anything happened. And I remember my dad waking me up. We lived in this little village, Old Denneby. People have heard me repeat this story, but, you know, we looked over onto some marshland and pasture, and the village of, the town of Mexborough in the distance, about a mile away. There'd be Mexborough Power Station, there'd be cooling towers to the right, and just like a strip of streetlights, terraced houses. But my dad woke me up to show me this sphere of light, and it was about three quarters of the way up one of the cooling towers and off it. It's hard to say from that distance how far off it. It could have been off it 50 feet, it might have been 10 feet. I were only a little boy, but I were looking at it through eye-powered binoculars. The ex-naval binoculars that my dad had. And we watched it, and we watched this thing slowly travel along the rooftops at Mexborough. And he left me about halfway through. I don't know why. Maybe he went outside to have a look at it. I don't know. I was in bed, you know, and I watched it. Then it went travelled full distance of Mexborough. But what's interesting, I wrote about that in The Night People as one of the first things that had stuck in my mind as of unexplained phenomena. And just recently, there's a guy contacted me from Conisbrough. If anybody's not familiar with area, it's probably about 2 miles from where this was seen, and said, you need to get to the archive in Mexborough because they've got a report of a UFO seen outside of the cooling towers at Mexborough Power Station.
Oh, my goodness.
In 1967. Well, I haven't got the report. It's about 100 miles from where I'm living now. But I'm going to have a rundown and see if I can get into microfilm and see if I can get this report. Doesn't make what I'm saying true, but it's interesting.
And it probably dates.
It's probably what I saw, and it probably dates it, which is, I don't know, it's fascinating, really, you know. And so that bit first time, and then after that, and all I saw was a sphere of light, lemony white coloured light that looked like it were turning. I think it was like within itself, just a ball of a large ball of energy, I must say, because when you compared it to the rooftops that it were travelling along top of, it probably quarter of the size of a rooftop in width. You know, I don't know about depth. It's a perfect circle. So that was it. And then after that, you know, over a period of from then, whatever age I was, say five, till 14, 13, 14, 15, I had what you would call encounters. And it's a difficult one because at one time, I wouldn't even speak about it, not because I was frightened to speak about it, because it's hard to get your head around that you've seen beings that you don't know how they've got into your room. Mm-hmm. You don't know. I've no concept of and there's not a start or an end to any of the sightings or experiences. They're just experiences, waking up and seeing them, being aware that they were there, laying there for hours and hours and hours waiting for these things to come after an encounter, because they were always frightening. And you might wait weeks, you might wait months. I've no idea, because at that age, you don't keep a diary. And I've got to admit, I was pretty useless at writing or anything all the way through school. So it's not always been there within me. And it were almost like you were in the moment and it had happened before you realised it were happening. It's a strange sensation. It's hard to explain. And then it stopped. It stopped till literally moving to this property I'm sat in now in between 1993 and 94. Oh, and it started immediately. And I don't mean it started within 6 months of moving in. It began immediately. And sometimes you think to yourself, not just my life, everybody's life. Is it all planned? Is there a reason for this? Because it literally did start up when I kept coming to this property, getting it habitable for Mary, my wife, and our four girls, because it were in a right state, to be honest with you. And I had to get hot running water on and get things working properly, this huge house. And it literally started within a few days of me coming up with my eldest daughter, Sarah, who would be about 9 or 10. And in between work, I were doing this on a Friday till Sunday. And that one of the nights, first couple of days, it happened again. And that happened then from 1994 to 1998, where luckily, thanks to Whitley Strieber advising me to get my doctor's medical records and everything else, we can see a pattern. We can see a date when it were all happening. And there's reams of paperwork, Shane, from doctors saying, words to the effect, not the words to the effect, and one of them actually does say this: we are perplexed by the punch hole lesions that keep appearing in this man's body.
Oh my goodness.
Every 3 to 6 months. And you know, once again, people, anyone listening to this, have I got any proof that what I'm saying is true? I've got proof of the lesions, I've got scars, I've got medical records that prove that's been said. Well, you're always going to get people say, well, yeah, but did you do it to yourself? Or do you know what I mean? It's different. We're in a no-win situation, yourself, Joe, and everybody else with an interest in this subject. Yeah. It is a no-win situation, because what you're talking about cannot be proved. If you're genuine and bona fide and you've had that experience, then you know in your heart that it's real.
That's right.
But you still can't beat the skeptically minded person who just laughs at you and says, show me proof. No. And I don't engage with that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anybody's seen it. I know the guy, I don't know him well, but there were a guy on a radio or a TV show just last week, I think, James Whale interviewed him.
Oh, yeah.
And people need to watch it because the guy, I think there's now on YouTube, it says James Whale clashes with UFO enthusiast or expert or something worse to that effect. Yeah. And he ends up shouting and bawling at him, does the UFO guy. It's there to see. And I felt a bit sorry for him, to be honest with you, but I don't know. Outrageous claims, as they say. Sort of need the proof, but in our case a lot of time we can't prove what we're talking about.
No, but I think that the important thing is that we're sharing these with each other, because
without a doubt. I believe it's proof en masse. I believe there is proof there by sheer virtue of the fact. So I don't want to put a downer on people listening saying, well, while we're listening to this guy, he says there's no proof of anything. There is proof, obviously. And I've got my own proof. And if we can couple that and everyone else's genuine accounts together, who are all independent to one another from decades and decades of sightings and experiences, then that has to stand for something, because not everybody is being deceitful.
That's it. And so just going back to your own experiences then, what sort of beings did you see as a child, if you're happy to talk about that?
I think the first time there were cows in field at back of us, Frisian cows. And I apologize, because I know I go around trees when I'm painting a picture for people, but I think it's important to know that, because they were integral. And I were laid in bed in the back bedroom. It early hours at morning, I can only assume, because it was dark. And back then in 1960s, if you hadn't got a lot of money, cheap and colourful curtains were made of fiberglass. And my mum had bought these, you wouldn't get away with it now, would you, fiberglass curtains? My mum had bought these like silvery coloured curtains that were in my room. And I remember waking up in the night, and this is another thing that with these encounters I can't get my head around. Because when I go to bed tonight, the room's black. Yeah, I could see the curtains. Yeah, I couldn't see a light coming from anywhere. And I weren't aware of a light, but yeah, I could see the curtains. Do you know? So I could see what I perceived were cow's eyes in the curtains. And I'm looking at them. And that's the only thing as a little boy I could relate to, something big and black. And that kind of size. And they were sort of moving forwards and backwards, and then they came out at curtains, and they were beings. They were not stood round, because bed, my mum all were moving it about, and sometimes it'd be at side at wall, sometimes it'd be offset, but they were around my bed looking at me. I was terrified. I don't know what happened, and I remember I couldn't scream, but I were screaming, but I couldn't make a sound. And these things were looking at me. I mean, how crazy! What a thing to be saying on a Monday morning at whatever time, you know. What a crazy thing to be saying. And these, they were there, and that's basically they were all cameos of events. And then there'd be other times when you'd suddenly become aware that they were there, but something was happening, some kind of procedure. I can only imagine, because it felt like, as anybody listening to this ever, everybody will have done, sort of laid on their arm and it goes dead. And if it's in middle at night and you realize your arm's gone numb, if you're very still and quiet, you can actually sort of feel it coming back to life. That's the feeling that I got all over my body, everywhere. And I can't say what were happening, but they were there. Do you know what I mean? And they were the same things that's been there through childhood that I saw through into the 1990s, 93/4 to 98. And I mean, when they did that to my back in 1998 and left them two big holes and one small hole in my back, they were telling me in my head that it were a bed spring turning in my back. You know, there's no bed springs protruding in our bed. And I think I must have passed out with pain, and I'd forgot about it the next morning until I sat on edge at bed and my wife, Mary, said, Paul says, I don't believe it. He says, you've got three holes in your back.
Oh, my goodness.
And then suddenly I remembered what had happened.
Yeah.
And, you don't know. I think they leave traces of, we won't say magic, but traces of the strangeness around the places that they've been, because this house now has been converted into three flats. I've done it, but there's things happened in the flats.
Yeah.
You know, I don't make a point of saying anything to tenants. There's nothing, I wouldn't want to frighten anybody. But over years, as they've been done, like, yeah, I don't know, gosh, going on 15 years, over years, people have come to me and said, well, one said, is this house haunted? And I asked them why. And then they said that somebody sat on the bed talking to them in the night. And then they'd lost all recollection of the conversation, but they felt the physical weight of the bed. They're all independent. They're not little, without sounding horrible to people, they're not grotty bed sits. They're all really flat, you know, they've all got their own locks on the doors, everything. And there's various other things happened, especially with top tenant who's in top flat now. And he talks about seeing dark shapes of people walking through his room and all sorts of things.
And is that what the shapes look like to you? Were they people or were they something else?
They were the shape. If we could say the shape of people, but no, has anybody seen the Plasticine Man morph?
Yeah.
And they were like that, what I saw, but they were elephant coloured, elephant skin coloured, and they'd got slightly larger heads. And that's something else I've thought about when people talk about aliens having large heads. I'm not saying I know this, but perhaps they haven't got large heads. Perhaps it's because their anatomy, their physical makeup, narrow clavicles and thin arms just make it look like their heads are unusually large. You know, perhaps they're no bigger than ours. I don't know.
did you sense a, you know, what kind of sense did you get from them? Was it one of, you know, did they come to do harm or did they come to help?
Childhood, it was fear. It was pure fear. Whatever they were doing. Once again, I wish I'd got an answer for this, but my gut feeling is that they wanted to create terror, fear in me.
Oh, that's really
and they managed it every time.
Yeah.
They managed it. And it was pure fear. And I think anything, let's face it, anything that sneaks up, should we say, or wants to appear in the night and don't want to make itself seen. Mm. I mean, we only have to look at predatory animals. They don't let you know they're coming, do they?
No.
They're just upon their prey and it's over and done with. I think anything that goes about its business in a deceitful, sneaky manner is not wholesome. It's not good. And I've never, ever had a good experience with these things. And I wouldn't knock anybody that said that they have. Here's where I kind of, not argue, but would differentiate with other researchers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got some researchers who believe that all of this is love and light and beautiful. I believe that's out there. But what I'd like these other researchers to do is acknowledge that it's not all that.
It's not all. No, I mean, I've spoken to people who have had really, really terrifying experiences with kind of goblin-like creatures who are interested often in children, in fact. Yeah. And they are horrible. You know, they've terrified these kids. They've done horrible, you know, scary sort of motions towards them.
Well,
and
I'm sorry for cutting across you, but
that's all right.
When I wrote Night People, I tried to collect as many accounts. I'd been writing every little instance that had happened in this book that I'd had for years and years. But you brought some of it up. And if anybody's read Night People, don't quote me on a year because I cannot remember off the top of my head. But it's in this house and it's got to have been, I would have thought, 2014, 15.
Okay.
And I were laid in bed during the night. Mary were in bed, but she didn't wake up. And I woke up in the night. This is the weird thing. What you shouldn't be able to see these things.
Many of us do.
And it was, yeah, but what I mean is there shouldn't be enough light to see what you saw.
Oh, I see.
So
right.
it's there's a little goblin-like thing. Because I know I said about what I saw, but that's another thought. It was stood on my chest.
Right.
And I think I shocked it because I don't think it wanted to be seen and I don't think it realised I were looking at it and it looked at me and sort of, there were a look of like, And it were furious that it had been seen, and it literally opened its mouth and nobody can see it gesture I'm doing, but it went ah, and showed me a mouthful of teeth and disappeared.
Horrible.
That was frightening. Gosh. And that were blue. It were blue coloured.
Right.
And so that's the only thing I've ever seen like that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pretend, I've seen this thing loads of times. One and only time I've ever seen anything like that. The other time, everything else were just about the same. Same kind of shape, sometimes a little bit smaller, sometimes like, I don't know, 3 foot tall, and a couple that have been about 5 foot tall. Mm-hmm.
More the grey sound, it, the grey sort of...
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, but yeah. Saying that though, I wish I had an answer. I just haven't.
Yeah, this is the thing. This is the thing. And I was reading in Truth Proof, the original Truth Proof book, your experience in 2013. Now that is really interesting. This is the experience with the stranger. Can you tell us that story, please? Because I find it absolutely fascinating.
About the guy on the street
with the bike.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I know it were late 2013, and it were a really bright, sunny day, and me and phones were quite useless, mobile phones, and I get four daughters. They've all left home now, but I get their hand-me-downs. So Jess had given me a phone, and I wanted to get it unlocked. So I decided to go to this shop round corner on my main promenade that would do it. Me and Mary walked out of our door, looking down street, I would say about 200 foot away. It fans out the street into a big fan. And there's a guy at the other side of the street, about 200 or 300 foot away, leant on wall with his jeans on and no shirt, looking at a paper with an old, very old green bike, like treacle tin colour green bike, the old type that you'd see in the old bread adverts. And he looked unusual, I must admit, but I didn't notice that at first. As soon as I come out of the door, he shouted over to me. I knew what he was shouting, but I didn't register. He was shouting, "You're bringing down the light. You've got to stop bringing down the light. You know what you're doing." But I'm not thinking anything unusual at this point, apart from, God, it's a cold day and he's got no shirt on, even though it's bright and sunny. So it's November, early December, or it is December. I'm not certain at date.
Yeah, I think November 13 I'd read here. Yeah.
So he's shouting these things at me, and I'm looking at his body, and I'm thinking, prior to this, I've probably never said on a podcast, but I've always trained weights from being about 16.
Yeah.
And entered bodybuilding competitions years and years ago. Probably the first time I've ever said this on a podcast, but I have. But not that it's any bearing on anything, but, you know, I think my biggest drawback was, not failure, is the fact that I weren't willing to take half of the drugs that these people wanted to take. And I really weren't. That aside, you get an eye for a good physique. Mm-hmm. And what were interesting was that there were no vascularity in his physique, really, just like the thick vein going down the side of his bicep and that. But for somebody so lean, so muscular, you'd have expected more kind of separation in his muscles and that. And he just looked like spam. He looked like an action man, which were odd. So I've dwelled too long on that. I go to the shop, get it unlocked, this phone. And in the meantime as well, the barber's shop, which faces up the street, they were observing this man. So John Butterfield, they call the guy, still there now. So I come back and he's at other side of the road. He's at our side of the road now. Now, he must have disturbed me that much that I was considering going round other way to avoid encountering him. So that were odd for me. But anyway, I'm coming back down. I says to Mary, I said, "Oh, God, that bloke's there, look." She said, "Oh," I said, "him, that him with bald head and his shirt off." Now he'd got a tight-fitting dark brown jumper on, a crew neck jumper. He got full wraparound sunglasses, but I couldn't see him at the time. So as I'm approaching, he literally just turned round and looked at me. And he went, "You know what you're doing. You're causing lots of trouble. You're bringing down the light." I said, "Excuse me." I says, "What are you talking about?" And then everything I said to him, he kind of twisted every word I had to say. I couldn't beat him. Mm-hmm. We aren't sounding... you don't need to beat somebody with words, but you like to think that you can stay on track with a conversation. And whatever I said, he turned round and made it the opposite of what I said. But the main theme was that I was causing lots of trouble. I was bringing down the light. I knew what I was doing. I had to stop. And I felt trapped. I felt like captured. I don't know why, because normally I'd have just walked off. And and all the time they're watching at the barber's shop. So any road, we turned the corner, and he just put his hand out and touched Mary's shoulder and then took it away really quick. And I'm looking at him and I can't see his eyes because he's got these wraparound sunglasses on. He's now got this jumper on and he's got this almost egg-shaped head. I don't mean alien-shaped either, people, but it would egg-shaped and this funny colour to his skin, almost like spam. Mm. And he goes, "I'm not talking about her. I'm talking about you. You know what?" And there were this exchange of thoughts, I'm sure of it. And I don't mean I had any mind speak, but he were almost predicting how far can I push this before this man, as in me, smacks him in the nose. I'll be honest with you, because as soon as he touched Mary on the shoulder, he moved his hand straight away, because my gut reaction was to grab his wrist and pull it away, and then there'd have been conflict. Yeah. And I'm not into conflict, people, so please don't think that, but I'm not really going to let somebody take advantage either. So he said, "I'm not interested in her, it's you. You know what you're doing, you're causing trouble." So I said, "I've heard enough of this," and I started walking away. But then just as I'm walking away, I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "Rickle." Well, I never even gave it a second thought. We got home, we looked at the CCTV, because we have CCTV, and he'd gone when we got. You see, everybody knows, I think, that your CCTV, it's useful, but it's not going to look 200 or 300 foot down the street and see anything with detail. Mm-hmm. So anyway, a few weeks later, and this wasn't the man, but a man went missing, because we discussed where we thought you were from. You know, we discussed, where did he say we're from? We couldn't quite get it in his heads. We couldn't remember. And a few weeks later, a man went missing at Bempton. And this is probably just coincidence, people, but it said he was from Rickle. Mm. It's a little village in North Yorkshire. Now, how coincidental is that? It definitely wasn't this man, by the way, either. No, it definitely wasn't him. But I found that fascinating. Though one more thing that I didn't pick up on. As he's having this conversation with me, this one-sided conversation, because I couldn't beat him. No, I there's no way I could match what he was saying to me, because every time I said something, he just turned what I'd said on its head. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I hadn't got an answer for him. But Mary, we're looking at his bike over the other side of the road. And when we got in, she said it had no brakes.
Yeah.
It's 45 miles away, Rickle. She said it didn't have any brakes on handlebars, which... odd in itself, but a strange story. And we sort of, me and Chris Turner did a documentary called Bringing Down the Light, and I kind of used title from that and title Truth Proof 3, Bringing Down the Light, you know, because that's what that guy was saying. And I can't work it out, Joe.
No,
it's
an odd one, but also I know that you'd written that, you know, not only did that man from Rickle go missing, but hadn't 11 men gone missing in that area between 2004 to 2014, because that was something you were investigating as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, I looked into him in Truth Proof 1, and he's, you know, I think there's some researchers out there, you know, that, and they've probably got good intentions, but they treat it almost as though it's entertainment. Mm. You know, I think I said at start of when we began talking, let's see if we can talk about things that are and entertain the listeners. But in a way, entertainment, I mean, that's maybe not the word, because when you're talking about disappearances and vanishing, we've got to be mindful of the fact that it's somebody's husband, it's somebody's son, it's somebody's daughter, you know, and we have to treat that with ultimate respect. So I've written about him in a book of unexplained phenomena, but at no point have I said that, I think this man or this lady has been involved in some kind of UFO abduction, because I don't think it would be fair. All I've done is highlight the fact that they've gone missing in a location that's renowned for unexplained phenomena.
This is it.
Three went missing. One went, I haven't got the exact dates in, but one went in December 2013, and another one went less than a month later in January 2014, and then another one went, but basically added up to four men vanished, and I don't mean they've ever been found. We'll say three men vanished from around the area of close to Bempton, two very close, two within half a mile of each other, one within 12 to 15 miles and another one 29 miles away, all on coast, vanished within 38 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I put freedom information requests in, and I've not got the answers back, because everything's so closed down now as regards giving out information, and rightly so in some instances. But I think these people, I think they deserve an answer. They deserve some kind of investigation that's a bit more thorough than what's being given to them. And I don't mean it's got to end in unexplained phenomena. You know, it could be something totally opposite to what we're looking into, but it still deserves a lot of attention when you break it down like that and you look at that, you know, four people in 38 days on the same stretch of coastline. You know, it's and that's just four. You know, the others are, there were a walker in 2004. These, we've got to be mindful of the fact of everything. You know, I mean, this unfortunate man could have fell and obviously been claimed by the sea. But he went walking and hiking for the day, November the 4th, 2004, it was, I remember. And he took his sandwiches and his walking stick and all his gear, parked at the car park at North Landing. Never been seen since. All his gear's inside car, sandwiches and everything. Never even got to go for his walk. You know, it's so strange. And then in between all that, Joe, there are people that have taken their own lives. You know, it's tragedies where people have suffered from depression, or I don't know, they've had some kind of crisis where they felt that they needed to end their own life.
Yeah.
And usually, I mean, I wouldn't even look into those cases, because that's established. The people I've looked at don't seem to have had any history of depression or trauma within their lives, although I don't suppose I know everything, but it's not being reported as such. And the ones that have taken their lives up on those cliff tops have usually been found sometime later, because the currents...
Yes.
Take the bodies, and they're usually found sometime later. But none of these people that I've looked into have ever been found. You know, it's tragic, really. And I hope I don't have to look at anymore. You know, it's
Well, there just seems to be so much activity around there, Bempton and Flamborough, and of course they're near RAF bases as well, which makes it interesting. But I also wanted to talk to you about these werewolf sightings. Now, this one particular one I'm thinking of is the Broxer werewolf that you've spoken about before and that I've been reading about, because you actually went down there, didn't you, and met the three men who had that experience.
Well, met two of them. You know, one of them wouldn't be interviewed, but when I say on camera people, I don't want everybody that I speak to or anybody that wants to give me their experience stroke encounter, don't think that I need you on film. It's just that we're doing a documentary called Wolflands, and we'd ask these witnesses if they'd contribute, and they have. Two of them have done, and it's incredible. We spent nights and nights in the forest with them since it were in 2018, I think it were August, that Jim, we won't say leader, but he was the guy who would find places for himself, Steve and the other witness, who we'll just call witness C, to go. And they used to love it. I mean, all hardworking men, and they'd two or three times a year, they'd go to some remote place, not necessarily in North or East Yorkshire. And they'd do a bit of fishing and set the camping gear up and take food and just enjoy it. And on this particular occasion, Jimmy found a place in a forest in North Yorkshire, close to Broxer Forest. And they arrived quite late, and they descended this ravine, which is 700 to 800 foot. It's very steep. You don't need ropes, but it's very steep. Honestly, it's really steep. Then it's got pine trees going all the way down it to the bottom. And when they got to the bottom, it was just about dark. No interest in unexplained phenomena. None whatsoever. None of them. They like fishing. They don't like to get drunk, but they'll sit and have a few beers and have some, you know, burgers and sausage or whatever they're doing on a fire when they've lit a fire. And that's their weekend that they do two or three times a year. And witness C suddenly started saying, "We have to go. I don't like it. We're being watched." Never done it before. Mm. Totally out of character. And they look at each other and think, well, we can't get out now. It's just took us over an hour to get down into this ravine in semi-daylight. And now it's dark. In some places, they went down on the bottoms because it's so steep. You know, you have to just shuffle down. So it's really steep. I mean, first time we met them, Les Drake, who was helping me film and make Wolflands, on way out, Les collapsed. We thought we were going to have to get an ambulance. It took us ages to bring him round because he's just not used to that kind of hard work as regards coming out of an 800-foot ravine. You know, and give him full credit, he's 66-year-old, you know what I mean? That's not, no disrespect to Les. So this goes on for a while and they're trying to calm him down. And then in the distance, probably about 30 to 40 feet away, a huge pair of amber eyes lit up in the darkness. Self-illuminating, no torch on them. Mm. Jim said they were human shape. Well, Steve did as well, but they were huge. And he held his fists out and said, "They were as big as your fists." He said, "They were really big eyes." And now he's really getting frightened. And they believe if it wasn't for him and them having to pour their attention onto him, they would have been even more frightened than they were. Because they thought he was going to run off into darkness. They now think the idea of this thing was to split them up. Mm. So they're watching, and Jim can't stand. This went on for about an hour, and Jim said, "I'd had enough in the end." He said, and I stood up, and I took a few paces towards whatever it was, and I can only see it about 3 foot off ground, these eyes, and made a few hissing and shooing sounds. Said, and then I turned back to Steve and other guy. He said, and because he disappeared. I need to add that bit. He disappeared when he made these noises. So I turned around and said, "We're all right now, it's gone." He said, but the look on their faces were just absolute sheer horror. He said, and I knew something really bad had happened. He said, and when I turned back and there's a bit of backlight from the moon, not a full moon, but there's a bit of backlight. He says, this thing now from being 3 foot off ground, these eyes were now 7 foot in air. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this thing that's just like it stepped from an horror film. He says, I've just never seen out like it, a terrifying sight. And huge, stupidly long ears. In Steve's words, you know, he said, if you'd have asked me to draw a werewolf, I wouldn't have drawn that. He said, I just wouldn't. He said, his ears looked ridiculous. They were that pointed and long.
Yeah.
And it turned, I think he said it turned to the right several times and they could see this exaggerated muzzle. And he said, they're talking about like Wile E. Coyote. Yeah. He said, I've never seen out like it. He said, we thought it were growling at us, but it wasn't. We realized after an hour, it were breathing, and it's just stood in like a stooped forward position, like an American linebacker, looking at them, terrifying them, glowering at them. And they're absolutely beside themselves. Steve in end said, I couldn't even look at it. I daren't even look at it. He said, I just wanted it to be over. And he meant death. He meant he wanted it to end it.
Yeah.
And it watched them. There's a bit of time discrepancy. It's interesting, this.
I hadn't picked up on that.
Well, you see, I probably didn't even write about it. I might have done, but Steve said it watched them till first light.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, when you're in a forest, even though you've got tree canopy and that, you sat all night, you become aware when daylight breaks through. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, you do,
So what people perceive as first light when they sat watching Emmerdale Farm and Coronation Street and rub their eyes at 8 o'clock is not the same as 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, do you see? Mm. So they'd watch this when they say all night. They might have watched it from 11 to 12 o'clock till 3 to 4 in the morning. But Jimmy only thought from it standing up to when it disappeared, it were only like a couple of hours. But he realizes it had to be longer, but he doesn't know why he thinks it were only that, because it only disappeared at first light. They realized it had gone because they were huddled together, didn't look at it. They could see it in peripheral, they could see its eyes glowing.
Yeah.
And then they realized it had gone. They gathered the things and got out at forest. What's interesting is that witness C, as they're leaving forest, said it's still here, still watching us. it's still watching us, it's still here. And then they got to a certain point in Forest and he says, we're all right now, it's gone. And during the experience, when it first appeared, he told those two, it doesn't want you here. It wants you to leave. It wants you to leave, Jim, and you, Steve. It don't want you here. So, which implies, and I've not got to the bottom of this, but it implies there was some form of communication.
Yeah.
And it were definitely focused on witness C.
Wanted him.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken away from this because, you know, people, I didn't go into this cryptid thing thinking there were any truth to it other than things from horror films. You know, it were only writing that first Truth Proof book that somebody contacted me about the Flixton werewolf.
Right,
and
yeah.
I kind of ignored it, you know, because I thought, well, I'm into me UFOs and I've seen things and I were a bit like the people I'm talking about who need to jump out of the box and accept the fact that other things are happening and not just your particular focus of interest.
Yeah.
And then I got another report from Flixton and I sort of started looking into it. And now it's as fascinating. I've got to admit, it's as fascinating as everything else. Spoken to Native American Indians, you know, elders and people who talk about the skinwalkers and their views on these things. And, you know, it's all cultures all over the world. You know, there's sort of dog-headed people, for want of a better word, that are depicted throughout time and throughout folklore in this country. You know, you've got they don't talk about them being bipedal, actually, on eastern North Yorkshire coast. They talk about these huge phantom hounds with glowing amber and glowing red eyes. So I think we're looking at the same things.
All over the world. That Flixton one, so this is, are you talking about the one that the man contacted you about when he was 11-year-old boy?
Yeah, that's
he and his friend. Could you tell us about that one? That was very interesting as well.
Yeah.
And these, I should say, many of these ones that we'll talk about, because with the Hackness Broxah werewolf as well in Cropton Forest, burial mounds and standing stones that being involved, and the Fae experiences as well, but we'll get to those. But
it's almost as though the ancient people knew that the land was special. I don't mean because of these apparitions or these sightings of these werewolf stroke dog-headed men. I think they knew other things happened, light phenomena. I mean, imagine in ancient times if you would have seen some weird spheres of light that are glowing and sparkling, golds and blues and reds, and you would have just maybe thought, wow, this is just incredible. No TVs in them days and no special effects, you know, so that would have been the highlight of somebody's life, seeing that, and let's stamp this piece of earth with something of our importance, our burial mounds, let's leave our most revered people here. Mm-hmm. But Flixton, they once again, two young boys, I think it was 1948, playing around a burial mound a very late summer evening. Burial mounds called Sharp Howe. It's a barrow cemetery at the top of Staxton Wold, and you can see the old RAF base in the distance. RAF base would have been there then as well, because it's the oldest operational RAF base in the world. So there's probably in sight now there'll be five burial mounds. So they're up around these burial mounds, and there's a tree growing out at the side of one of them. There still is today, numerous thick trees. So this thing's just sat with its back to a tree in the crouch position, looking at something in its hands, and its head's down. Basically, they've described a man covered in fur with a dog's head. And he said it slowly just lifted its head and looked at them, and they turned and ran. Well, they were both able to tell the story right up until, you know, a few years ago, one of them passed away. Mm-hmm. And he stuck with them all this time. So it's not a predator. It's not something. There's too many reasons why they're not here. I mean, even if we consider that the landmass in America and the forests in Alaska and all these places and the Appalachian Trail and all these could maybe hide and support these kind of things. we're getting these reports on cliff tops at Bempton. There's just not here. There's something more than a normal flesh and blood animal. There are the things that they do, the instances of fear that they can instill in people, the instances of almost communication without speaking that people are getting from these things. And, you know, in America, you know, with the gun laws, obviously they're allowed to hunt and they've got high velocity weapons. And they're talking about, having these things in their sights and shooting them, as they say, center mass, and it having no effect.
These
same hunters will still say, oh, I believe they're animals, though, even though they've just shot it with a bullet that will drop an elk or a moose. And, you know, they're contradicting themselves. We've got to, simply because it don't fit with their narrative. It's not going to fit with their mindset if they don't believe that anything that I'm talking about and other people are talking about could be reality.
This is it. And it seems like, I mean, they're just not going to be able to get their heads around that, and that's fine, you know. And people come to these recognitions and truths in their own time. But I mean, it does seem that they're not entirely of this physical world, that they, you know, have some kind of lighter vibration to them, that, you know, that they are able to move between these worlds in some way. I just going back to the one in the woods there that you described with the three men. Was there any scent? Was there, you know, when they heard, so they heard the noise of the breathing that they initially thought was growling.
I asked them if they smelt anything and they didn't. I'll tell you what's interesting though, Joe. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I went to Flixton Wold, which is, I told you that the old guys, well, they weren't old, the young boys back in 1940s, claimed to have seen this thing on Staxton Wold. Well, we're only talking about a mile away. Flixton and Staxton had virtually just joined. Yeah. And I went up there. I don't know the exact year, but I went into a certain part of woodland and my little dog with me, and I got three tree knocks right again me. I've never been the person, we don't go into the forest and start knocking on trees. We just go in and camp, and that's what we do. I'm not into making daft noises and doing tree knocks. No disrespect if that's what you do, but it's not for me. But they were right again me, and I couldn't account for them because they were only me and little dog there and no wind. And it were almost like, we always try to find analogies for these things. And if you picture a 2-pound lump hammer, what a bricklayer would use, it were like somebody had just hit a tree with three times with this hammer. So I sat down, bought a coffee and just hoped it, put an Olympus recorder on and thought, come on, please do it again. But nothing happened.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, I don't know, say 2 or 3 months later, I took granddaughter into the forest with me, Tegan, and we little dog once again. And same area. This strikes back to what you were saying. We got the most vile smell of sulfur, rotten eggs. And and literally the same area. It were absolute stench of rotten eggs. And we got out of area. We went back, I don't know, probably half an hour later, because I wanted to see if it was still there. And it had gone. So that was a strange one, just there, you know.
Very interesting. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Joshua Cutchin's work, The Brimstone Deceit.
No, I'm not. No.
Okay. Well, I'll send you a link to a chat that I had with him. But he's written this book, The Brimstone Deceit, and it's an absolutely fantastic piece of research about supernatural scents. It's an in-depth examination of supernatural scents, otherworldly odors, and monstrous miasmas. Now, he describes that exact kind of smell that you're talking about. And of course, Joshua is an expert in Bigfoot, you know, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, whatever you like to call it. But this smell is very much associated, and of course, is the knocking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
You
know, even though what we've got in Flixton is, as I've called them in the book, the accounts of the Flixton werewolf. Mm. I'm aware that some of the things that are described are almost Bigfoot related, and the spittle inn stands on the foundations of the former Carman's Spittle at the bottom of Flixton Brow, which in 937 AD were built to protect travellers from wolves. And the writing goes, an infestation of savage beasts. Now, I went to look at the deeds at the Spittle Inn. I contacted the owners and they'd got the deeds at home in a safe. and they let me look at the deeds. And what were interesting was that the lady who owned the property with her husband, she looked up onto Staxton Wold where we could see as we sat talking, and she says, "I think there's a Bigfoot up there in them woods." Mm. And, you know, just a strange thing to say. You know, do you know, but it's a fascinating place. Yeah. You know, I mean, I found that fascinating, the wording from wolves.
Yes.
So we know that we know wolves would have, there'd have been loads of wolves about in 937 AD. But what were the infestation of savage beasts? Because bears would have gone 2,000 to 1,500 years before. So apart from wolves, we didn't have an apex predator. So I find it fascinating that they reference an infestation of savage beasts, and what could they have been? And then Athelstan, it was the king that sort of had all this done, the then king, King Athelstan. He said, "And a portion of land in this vicinity shall be forever known as Wolfland."
Okay, interesting. Yeah, well, there's so many, as you've written about in your books, there's so many of these place names. You look back in history, you've got your Hun Dykes, which means the watercourse Hun Dykes,
yeah,
around Flixton, Hound Dykes. You've got the local burial mound, Wolf Howe, which means Wolf Hill, you know, and all these other places that really tie in.
You've got 2 miles from Flixton, you've got Hundmanby, which quite literally means, people want to research it, farmstead of the Houndman.
Houndman, yeah, now, amazing.
Now, what's fascinating, we kind of need to keep our feet on the ground. Some scholars, some researchers, should we say, say that it's called Farmstead of the Houndman because the king used to keep his hounds there, but they're forced to admit that there's no proof of that. They don't really know. So I'm not saying that that isn't true, but without any proof of it, and with all this anecdotal proof, let me correct myself, where people claim to have seen this bipedal fur-covered creature,
yeah,
is that why it's called Farmstead of the Houndman? Do you, you know, yeah, that's the arrow that I would throw, and it's fascinating, you know, and the more you go down this rabbit hole, the more fascinating it becomes.
It is. And as you say, there's just such, I mean, I'm the same. I'm, you know, completely behind with all the people that I need to speak to about their experiences, because there are just so many. And, you know, there's just so much out there of just ordinary people's extraordinary experiences. Now, I wanted to ask you also about the Staxton Wold being. So the elf, how the strange lights that were there, and the little people that were seeing, the little men. Can you tell us about that, please?
Well, there's light form phenomena being seen around Elf Howell. Anybody wanting to visit that burial mound now would probably struggle to know, apart from a small, I think the plough's just about eradicated most of Elf Howell, which is a shame. Yeah. But this is years ago when I first started writing that first book, that a private contractor were working up at a farm up at Staxton. And because I asked, he knows that I'm interested in the light form phenomena, the spheres of light that are seen all around it's called the Wolds. These places are around the Wolds people. The Wolds means in ancient times the wilds. So, where am I going with it? I asked him if any farmhands have seen these spheres of light, and it sort of covertly asked these questions. But while they were working up there, and they worked up there several years because they were good at what they were doing, and they were doing pig units, you know, that's what they were building, and all sorts of things. He said one day, he said, because these people, some of them have got their own tenanted houses and they've got their own canteen. He said, we're in canteen, and somebody just come running in and said, just seen one. He said, and everybody went quiet because me and my son were sat in there. Mm-hmm. But over a period of months and months, as they got to know these people, it turns out that they were seeing glimpses of little beings. So he said, they're not interested in lights. They've gone well beyond lights, what you're talking about. Yeah. They're actually seeing beings. And they're ploughing a field, and there's nothing in the field, obviously, but apart from soil that they're turning. And they'll see legs run past them, just legs. And I don't mean a hair, legs. And they'll look, and then they can't see anything else. Or they'll see the shape of a body, small, 2 or 3 foot tall. And they're seeing these things. They saw one in farmyard. That's that particular day when they came running in. Turns out that they'd seen one stood in farmyard. So what they are, Joe, I have no idea. He weren't privy to any of that information for months and months and months until they felt comfortable with these two men. Because when I say it were his son's not 15 or anything, you know, he's a grown man himself. So,
yeah,
you know, and obviously then you've got the light form phenomena that's seen around the burial mounds. You know, you've got the famous burial mound at Burton Fleming, Willie Howe.
That's a good one, yeah.
Probably one of the most prominent burial mounds in the United Kingdom. If anybody's not familiar with it, you know, do a bit of Googling and you'll find that, I don't know how many years ago now, hundreds of years ago, William of Newburgh sort of chronicled a story about a man who passed the Howe in the dead of night on his horse, and there's a big hole in the side of the burial mound and all light pouring from it. He stops and looks in and he says, they describe, they're not going to say aliens, are they? Let's face it, because we're in a different age. We're going back hundreds of years. And you can see hobs and goblins all banqueting. And there's music and merriment. They see him and everything stops. And one second, I'll just take this cup. Thank you.
Yeah.
They see him and everything stops. And one of them comes over and offers him a drink in this cup, this strange, unusual cup, should we say. And the story goes that he knew not to drink from the cup as become enslaved to the fairies or the beings that resided in the mound. So he tipped the contents out and sort of dug his heels into his horse and did a runner with being pursued by the people from within the mound. And he jumped the gypsy race, which is the stream that's got lots of strange stories attached to it in itself, the gypsy race, and escaped with the cup. Now, what it becomes interesting for me is, and I might have got my king wrong, but I think it was given as a wedding present to Edward the Elder. Right. And, you know, so it did exist. The cup exists. Whether the story is one man's imagination or something that's just got added to throughout time, I don't know. But the burial mound in itself is quite magical. Canon Greenwell excavated it in the 1800s. He did a lot of excavations to burial mounds and earthworks around eastern North Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. And he notes that no burial mound that he'd ever worked on had as much atmosphere and strangeness as Willie Howe. And I've got a pilot who flew over the top of Willie Howe and has missing time in a light aircraft. Mm-hmm. You know,
and the guy, didn't that the local dog walker in 2006?
I was just going to say the local dog walker who'd never had an experience about anything like that. So a little man stood at side of the Howe, dressed in ridiculous clothing like you would expect to see in almost, I don't know, medieval.
I'd written it down here because I've seen something myself that, you know, a little green man that was about 3 foot high and dressed in a sort of similar way to what's being described here. Well, not leather, but he describes it as skin brown with age, which is the kind of being I saw, just so wrinkled and brown, just an ancient skin. To this being that I saw. So he says, skin brown with age, leather waistcoat, baggy brown trousers, unusual hat, black and shiny eyes, you know, that kind of archetypal fairy gnome type being.
He stopped him walking his dog. You know, he didn't walk back there, you know, frightened. And unless you've got something else to say there, I've got something else in my mind.
Yeah, please, yeah.
Some poachers, but not at Willie Howe. They were actually at Gransmoor, which is probably about 3 miles from where I'm sitting now, near Carnaby. In early evening, or it weren't quite dark, and they're setting out with a couple of dogs and they're going to go poaching. And one of them, and I don't know why the dogs didn't do it, because they've told me the story, one of them saw a little man, a little being, in the hedgerow. Now, listeners, I can only report what I'm told. He booted it.
Oh no.
Yeah, he kicked it. He was that shocked when he saw it, he kicked it, and he just sent it flying into grass, and that was the last he saw of it.
Oh, God, what happened to him after that is what I'd like to know.
Nothing, as far as I know, but, I'd like to add to it some sort of magical element, but that's all I've got. But it's a first-hand account, but that's all I've got. I haven't got, and he had bad luck ever since, or this happened to him and his dog's fur dropped off. There's none of that. Do you know what I mean? It's just, you've got what I've got. And it's crazy things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, around that area as well, around Willie Howe, I think this one happened in the area. The local elderly woman, she said there was a knock at her door, and this is going back into UFO territory now, but she said there was a knock at the door and she had a discussion with a man. And then she, the next minute, all she remembers is looking at a UFO looking like.
Yeah, got the drawing. I've still got the drawing.
That's right.
I thought I'd lost it, actually, but, you know, and yeah, there's a back door of a home. These are little cottages in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And there's a knock on the door. She goes, like you've just said, goes to the door, answers the door. She recalls having a discussion with somebody, but she can't even remember who it was or what it looked like or anything. Mm. If I've got, you know, we're going back. My head's swimming with information, Joe. So do you know what I mean? So I think that's where we are with this one. It's an early one. And she remembers then seeing, she did a painting of a black tube with white, not quite square, I think the slightly oblong windows, as we're perceiving, along it. But crazily, it had a trunk, like an elephant's trunk, below it, sweeping the ground. There's all fields at the back of her, and almost like a hoover. So from speaking to this person, that she's then stood at the door watching this. Just, I know we can't account for these things, but that's... Yeah, that's the one that you're referring to, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But it sounds very much also like the one in, is it Leslie Buttle in Bessingby, Bridlington? Leslie, those three women, 1977, that was.
I'm so grateful that Leslie shared that story with me, and I've spoken to her many times, and I see her most Saturdays, if only just to say hello, and I just pass a few words with her, because the other ladies have passed away. And that's on Bessingby, so very close to Carnaby, where we've just and Gransmoor, where we've just been saying. Yeah. That's on Bessingby Industrial Estate, and they worked at Britax. I think they used to make car parts, windscreen wiper blades, so, and things.
An old factory.
An old factory. Still there, factory, but now it's a dentist and split up into other things. One of my daughters works there. And anyway, they're cleaners, and they're going to Britax. And I think the time might have been about 10 to 5 in the evening. And they see this strange cloud. There's an allotment outside at factory, you know, growing vegetables and what have you. And they see this strange cloud. It's a clear night. It's just, you know, crisp night. And they can't work out this cloud. It looks oval-shaped, really weird, out of place, and it looks low. Then the mist cleared, and there's an egg shape, egg on its side-shaped object. It's about as big as a family saloon car. And it's rotating. Don't ask me which way it were rotating. She has said, you know, the middle of it's got a band that's moving round, and they suddenly become very, very frightened. They're terrified, froze to spot looking at this thing. She said all airs on their arms stuck up, all static. It was terrible. And the tube dropped down from it, a green tube. Now, they're not sure. I mean, I've spoke to Leslie many times and gone through this with her. She's not sure if it were a tube or a light, but a tube of light, we'll say. Mm-hmm. And then things from the allotment, and not just vegetables, anything, were just going up into this tube like a hoover. And then I think there were more than one. It was seen at the woodland yard. It was covered in a UFO magazine as well years ago, but they didn't do as good a story on it as what I did. And no disrespect at people, by the way. I'm not trying to say I'm better, but there's nothing like speaking to the witness.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And they didn't speak to the witness. This got reported in local paper, what they'd seen, and somebody created a story out of it just based on newspaper reports. I mean, you don't have to be too idle to actually, you know, jump in your car and go see these people. Mm. You know, I think magazine were based in Leeds, so it weren't that far away, but that's as it was. So these things leave, and they go into a factory and tell everybody what they've seen, and they're just laughed at. The machinery in the factory had stopped. Mm. And I think everything had stopped at 10 to 5.
It says 444, which I'm quite, I think that in itself as well is quite interesting.
Right, well, fair enough, because she said a lot. You've got to understand, Joe, that I haven't got this information.
Oh, I know, sorry, not at all. I'm taking you back now to some of the earlier ones.
So basically then 444. And they couldn't get the machines going for some time. And then when they got some of the machines going, I think they were running backwards. They couldn't work it out anyway. Nobody could, but they were laughed at. One of the ladies were called Margaret Mooney, and she never spoke about it for years. I just missed out on speaking to Margaret. You know, she passed away. Mm. But as I say, I've got in-depth information off Leslie, more than she wanted to tell us. You know, they all suffered from sickness afterwards and sort of vomiting and things, you know, which did nothing like that had been reported to local paper. And I found out afterwards that when they saw it, and if you've got the information with you there, whatever day they saw it, on the Sunday, officials came from somewhere. I don't even know if I wrote about this. I might have found about it afterwards. But they opened the town council up, officers, and they wanted to find out whose allotment specifically it was on. And they got, they obtained permissions and that, and they went on to allotment then, and they did an investigation on covering the allotment.
Yeah, so this is known, you know, this is what is kind of frustrating. I mean, I know we're never going to get the answers, fully, but it's known. We know it. The governments clearly know it. Everybody know the, you know, governments do a really good job of ridiculing people and situations, and it tends to do is, as you've just described there, is try and shut people up,
just close them down. You've just brought up I've just talked about something there and set my mind off thinking to myself, I've never contacted council and tried to get some kind of freedom of information request in to take me back to that date to see whether people actually came to open this allotment up. Do you know what I'm saying? I know I'll make a note of this and I will do this.
Great.
Because, you know, it's the kind of thing that needs doing. I mean, in a few weeks' time on our Truth Proof live stream, we're going to interview Rick Doty. And I recommend anybody listen to him. A wonderful guy. I got to speak to him at Awakening when I spoke there about a month ago. And he's from America and he was speaking. And his job, we're not going into great detail about his job, but basically his job was to spread disinformation about, because you've just touched on that, about people's UFO sightings, people's strange encounters. And now he's coming clean about that. He's not liked by some people because of that job. Mm. But we can't all be liked. I mean, I have no idea what wages the man were on. And he worked at, I think it was Central Intelligence. I could be wrong. And but at least the word's getting out now.
Exactly.
The truth's getting out now.
That sounds great.
I've lost time for him. And I noted in comments when I've looked at a few live streams or a few podcasts and things that people have been a bit negative, but I speak as I find.
You know, the main thing is that we're all kind of looking at this together, and that's the only way in which we'll kind of move forward. And that's not to say that we're going to come up and, you know, shout out, oh, look, here's the answer, because that's not what it's all about. Sometimes it's about exploring together and just kind of shifting, you know, expanding outwards our shared knowledge and understanding. And I think there's something, you know, very enlightening about that. I think that's what, you know, you could argue perhaps that's what we're here to do on this earth, is kind of to expand our consciousness or enlightenment, as it were. And something about this time, and I've spoken to a lot of other researchers about this too, and listeners and viewers, is that there does seem to be this expansion right now, this expansion of knowledge and awareness. And maybe, you know, we're moving forward in some way as in our evolution on this earth. But it certainly does seem at the moment that, you know, much of what has been kept in the dark in the past is now sort of slowly being revealed.
It is. And, you know, the knowledge is the actual phenomena, the actual things that we're dealing with are probably the same things from the past. It's probably us as we're evolving that we're becoming more accepting of the reality that these things. I mean, before we've allowed mainstream science to stamp on any notion that these things, there could be some reality to these things, but now it's becoming increasingly difficult when we realize that actually bona fide scientists are looking into this and are taking it seriously. And it makes it very difficult for the dyed-in-the-wool sort of regimented man of science, because I realize that science is about proof and fact, but it's still very difficult when you've got your people within your own circle of academia that are taking it very seriously. It's good we're getting more people involved.
That's true. That's really, it's true. Well, I'm really excited about your work, Paul. I think you're going to have to come back on, because we haven't even touched on the Cropton Forest werewolf, which is absolutely fascinating and chilling, the experience that guy had.
That's true, John. You know, the Cropton one, it's only 7 miles from Broxah. Yeah. I use Broxah as a sort of pin in the board, because it's
epicenter.
It's very close. And, and what we didn't touch on is, in folklore, a Broxah is a shape-shifting demon. Mm. You know, the interesting name, strange name for a forest. It's very close to Silpho Forest, where in 1954, you've got the story of the Silpho flying saucer that was said to have landed. Yeah. You know, fascinating. You can see each forest from any these vantage points, literally a mile away from each other, 3/4 of a mile away from each other. When we've got, they're all named, but they're all linked. They're just portioned off, I should imagine, by various people who've owned the land over the years. You know, there's no big fences between them saying this one's Cropton and this one's Broxah. Everything kind of links. It's just that they've all got separate names.
Well, I'm feeling like I must get up there and experience these places for myself. I think, do you think a lot of people are flocking to these areas now?
Without a doubt, I'm getting more and more people coming to the cliff tops at Bempton. And I'm keen to stress, Joe, you know, I said you might go, but you might have to go for a lifetime before you experience something. But all I will say is that you're in a location where there's more probability of something happening than most places. And, you know, go on that premise, because don't go thinking, yes, something's going to happen. You said it yourself, I must get up there and experience these places, because I think that's the attitude to go with. Not go up there and I want to see UFOs, I want to see light forms, because Paul's written 4 books, and we know I've done 5, but one's about my own experiences. Paul's written 4 books, and 70% of it is along this eastern North Yorkshire coast, the content. But it spans decades. These sightings span decades. But that's not to put a damper on anybody listening who wanted to visit. I will say, though, the RAF base is out of bounds. You know, I've got to stress that, because I'm pretty sure that the first time I started advocating that it were you need to explore that spot. If anything, anybody got hurt on it, it's private land. People would be after me, wouldn't they? And it's totally out of bounds.
Actually, that's something, just lastly, I did want to mention, and I'll ask you about, is that, you know, from time immemorial, the royal and governmental military do seem to have placed their bases on these sacred sites. You know, if you look down in Somerset, a lot of military activity down there. A lot of these spots, a lot of these sacred sites have had military bases kind of plonked on them over the ages. What do you think about that?
Probably a lot of significance, or we could dress it up in another way. You know, I've talked about RAF Staxton Wold being the oldest operational RAF base in the world, but it's also the highest point of land around. But it's also the place where the light forms are seen, UFOs are seen, close to the cryptid, the Flixton Werewolf. So did they place it there because of the height, the vantage point? Because it was a Roman hill fort. Long time before that. But then you've got RAF Filingdales, which is the early warning system. That's very close to these forests, Cropton, Stape, Broxah. It's very close, within like a few miles of these forests. So you're right in what you're saying. And it's fascinating, isn't it? You know, the military installations are in places where these things are being seen. I mean, is there so much activity and sort of brain power poured into these places that it attracts unexplained phenomena?
Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of power surge that comes, through the landscape, and something to do with ley lines and
Well, be because at Bempton you've got the Bempton Fault, which sort of runs along, and you've got the magnetic anomaly that runs out to sea, and the anomaly spreads inland and goes up to around Fylingdales. Do you know? So, there's a lot of talk about negative magnetic anomalies being the epicenter of unexplained phenomena. Steve Mirra, who's a great researcher, and you need to get him on at some point. And Barry Fitzgerald as well. They talk about it. I'm not sure that they're right. I think there's some truth in the magnetic anomalies having some kind of purpose or some kind of role in this. My own feeling is that whatever's happening is on the peripheral of the anomaly, where the positive and the negative are in constant flux. But once again, I'm only speculating. It's all fascinating. Wherever road you go down, I mean, you could spend a lifetime, or you could spend years and years just studying the magnetic anomaly and the potential for unexplained phenomena, or collecting accounts that are happening around it. But that kind of box you then, wouldn't it? You'd be just in one section of a much wider net. We've just got to spread it and just keep looking.
Well, thank you for all the work you're doing, Paul. It's just brilliant, and I can highly recommend your Truth Proof series. Absolutely, absolutely loving them. I must get your the latest one you released is Night.
No, actually, Night People's not the latest yet.
Okay, what's the
So
latest?
we've got the first Truth Roof, then we've got one, two, and three. And then I wrote Night People.
Ah, before four,
Yeah, and
right.
then I wrote Truth Proof Four. Yeah. And can I just give a little plug to the website?
Please do,
Yeah,
please
yeah.
do.
So the website is truthproof.uk, and there's lots of UFO reports on there that you'll not find anywhere else. So, some of them are quite detailed, some are just a few paragraphs, but they're still unique and the first-hand accounts. Anybody with a website who wanted to use them, feel free to copy and paste. Please just give our website or me reference for the sighting, and that's good enough for me. The books can be obtained, the paperbacks can only be obtained through that website, truthproof.uk. If you want Kindle versions, they're on Amazon. And yeah, just read the reviews first. There's lots of reviews on Amazon about the books, and form your own opinion before you decide you're gonna, if you were gonna purchase a book, before you make any decisions.
And your own website, you were mentioning you do live chats then. Haven't you got a podcast as well? Are you still running that, or is it
Yeah,
just, yeah?
I'm a bit slow with that, aren't I? Every Thursday, we run a live stream direct to YouTube. It's the Truth Proof live stream. So we get some fairly interesting guests on, some of them spectacular, to be honest. At least expected ones are the ones that are just not as well known turn out to be just as interesting as everybody else.
Oh,
And
yeah.
so it's 7 o'clock till 9 most Thursdays. And
Yeah.
as I say, we've got Rick Doty on in a few weeks' time. We've had Whitley Strieber on. We've had Jim Segala, the scientist from Skinwalker. As Steve Mirra, we've had some great guests on, as well as people who are just, I wouldn't say straight off the street, but people who've had extraordinary experiences but don't usually talk about these things.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, the kind of stuff we love
Yeah,
and we need to
exactly.
hear. So this is fabulous. Thank you so much, Paul.
You're
And
welcome.
yeah, please come back again. I'd love to chat to you another time.
Will do. Thank you very much. Pleasure.